The Guardian.
Book of the Week with Claire Armistead on guardian.co.uk.
What makes a great travel book? We asked this question on Twitter and in the Guardian Books blog and got a wonderful range of responses. One tweeter nominated Freya Stark's The Valleys of the Assassins. I followed her footsteps in Iran, a superb guide, plus she wore cool hats. Another raved about Rose Macaulay's Towers of Trebizond. Made me desperate to go to Turkey and travel round, on a camel. The Towers of Trebizond is, of course, a novel, and therefore wouldn't be eligible for either of the two big prizes that have been awarded in the last few days. One is the Samuel Johnson Prize for Non-Fiction, which was won by the American writer and journalist Barbara Demick for a book about North Korea. We'll be making our own trip across the world to Beijing to talk to her later in the programme. But first, the other prize announced this week was the Dolman Travel Book of the Year, the UK's only prize devoted to travel literature. The winner was The Dead Yard, The Story of Modern Jamaica by Ian Thompson, who joins us here in the studio along with Brett Wollstonecroft, co-founder of the independent bookshop Daunce and one of the judges of the prize. Ian, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
You're becoming a bit of an old hand at winning prizes, aren't you? Because this is actually the second one this book, The Dead Yard, has won.
Yes, the other was the Ondaatje Prize, which is a Royal Society of Literature award, given for a book that celebrates a sense of place. And I think if we're going to talk about travel literature today, the sense of place for me is crucial. There are a lot of travel books around that go from A to Z on a sort of journey, but my favourite travel books actually stay in one place.
Now, Brett, as a bookseller, you could presumably pick out any number of sections to stock The Dead Yard in, couldn't you? It could be in history, it could be politics, it could be identity, colonial studies.
That's absolutely right, although, I mean, as a bookshop, we're arranged by country, and indeed you touched on the Towers of Trebizond earlier. We take a very wide view of what a travel book is, and therefore we would even include novels within travel sections. But yes, we could put this book in four or five different sections, and it would probably at the moment be the best book in all of them.
Mm-hmm. Now, the book is called The Dead Yard, The Story of Modern Jamaica, Ian. You did go to Jamaica to report it, but it's not in any simple sense a travel book, as we've said.
No, in the sense that, travel right. I think let's start with the premise that before tourism, there was travel, and before travel, there was exploration. And I think that writers in the Victorian times were often amateurs of science, that they brought back information of empirical usefulness with them. We can't do that anymore because the world is known to us. Everybody knows where Timbuktu is. It's sort of beamed into all our front rooms by television. So a travel book has to be something different. And mine, I think, is... rather than concentrating on exploration or geography, it's really an investigation into the changing political climate in a country. So for me, that's what a good travel book should do. It should offer a narrative of inquiry into a changing situation in the country politically.
And it takes you way back into colonial history, doesn't it? In a way,
yes.
You could say it's about the colonial psyche as well as about the psyche of the once colonised.
Yes, absolutely. And it was important for me when I was writing this book to interview people from both sides of this divide, as it were. But the narrative thread that runs through it, like the sort of black line in A Lobster, is the story of the returnee. So the book actually is in some ways an anti-travel book. It's less about abroad and much more about home. That's to say, the motherland, so-called England, for the Jamaicans who came here in the 50s and 60s, is that their country anymore? What is Jamaica to them now? Long brooding over the loss of your homeland can sort of sweeten its reality in your absence. So I was investigating these themes of return and homecoming and exile, which are perennial literary themes. They're as old as Homer.
Now, Brett, tell us why this book stood out from the shortlist. It's a really distinguished shortlist, isn't it? It goes from Horatio Clare's A Single Swallow Following the Journey of the Swallow Across the World to Lost and Found in Russia, a couple of Russian books, actually, Out of Step by Daniel Metcalf as well, Along the Chanted Way, William Blacker, 11 Minutes Late by Matthew Engel, Parish.
The discussion as to who should win the prize was a very difficult one because we ended up disagreeing or arguing about the very thing we're talking about here. What is a travel book? And Ian's book, I think you are getting deep under the skin of a country, deep under into its culture. You're really, understanding what is at the heart of that culture. Ian has put music at the heart of this culture, and music as a way of explaining so many of these different moods and changes in Jamaican politics. It's a wonderful theme that runs through the book. But most of all, if I was going to pick the reason that I thought this was a very worthy winner, is a great travel writer has a great ear, has a great ear for conversation and for anecdote. And the anecdotes throughout this book, and indeed the wry sense of humour that comes across with it, would be why I would pick this book. I learnt a great deal, but it's also tremendously entertaining.
Let's just talk about music and film. You go and you find some of the greats, don't you? You know, just sort of hanging out, such as Ernest Ranglin, Jazzer, old Jazzer, known for, you know, from Ronnie Scott way back when.
Yes, I think he first came to Britain in 62 or 1. Anyway, just at the moment when Jamaica was winning its independence from Britain. And he was an old guy, pretty well sort of forgotten here in Britain, I think, but in Jamaica still very much a hero. And I have a huge jazz collection at home, and Ranglin has always been in it. So I was amazed in some ways to find that he was still around, and he was a wonderful interviewee. A lot of the music I listened to growing up in London in the 70s was influenced by reggae, which was coming through then in a huge way. A lot of the sort of very English bands like The Clash were absorbing lots of Jamaican rhythms, and I decided in a way to sort of go back to that time of my youth and celebrate this music again.
Mm-hmm. And then one of my favourite encounters was with the film director Perry Hernsel, who did The Harder They Come, of course. And he's hanging out in a house called Itopia with a mural by Joni Mitchell.
Yes.
Now, is that surreal or what?
It was very surreal. I didn't actually get to use that room, but I was told about it, and I have no reason not to believe it. A lot of sort of famous people had trooped through there in the past. Jamaica, I think, in the days before it became much more of a sort of alarming country politically, did attract an awful lot of sort of tropical voluptuaries, among them people like Noel Coward and Mick Jagger. The Rolling Stones recorded not a very good album there. Jamaica has had this reputation, Ian Fleming, of course, latterly too.
Mm-hmm. But you also have encounters of a much more sombre kind, don't you? For example, I was very struck by your meeting with Peter Mace, is it, or Mice, the lawyer?
Oh, yes.
Lawyer who in
Peter
a, in
Mace,
a
yes.
Peter Mace in a very, very rundown area of
yes.
Kingston. Tell us about that and what happened to him.
Well, he was a lawyer in uptown Kingston, that's to say the sort of more salubrious neck of the city, who was doing a lot of work for the poor, usually in conjunction with Jesuit priests who tend to sort of hunker down among the poor and take great risks, actually. About 2 weeks after talking to him, his wife was murdered in a church. To me, it was very, very shocking, and I spoke to him briefly afterwards, but it quickly became apparent that this wasn't such an unusual occurrence in Kingston, and that I had just brushed against this sort of instance of mortality more or less accidentally, just meeting him.
And this is a person who's chosen to live in a downtown area where you have a lot of description of the places where the pathologists are frightened to testify at postmortems because there is so much death and there is so much violence, and they've chosen to live there, and then they suffered the consequences of that choice.
It probably is true to say they've chosen to live there, more like pitch tent there. They've probably got a house in uptown Kingston too, but they spend a lot of their time there for sure. I think downtown Kingston paradoxically is less edgy a place than midtown, where downtown you're sort of watched and observed and you're accepted as someone who's going around taking notes, or someone who's even lost their way socially is just accepted as someone who's a bit eccentric. But midtown, I found it more of a hairy part.
Now let's broaden this out a little bit, Brett. One of the comments we had in response to my blog about this win was from somebody called I Am Brian Schofield, who says that travel writing is in a sticky state, and he blames Bill Bryson for it, among others. What do you say to that?
I think we could blame Bill Bryson for a great number of things, but no, I don't take that view. I think travel writing, as partly evidenced by this award, is in a good state. I think a lot of different strands of writing have fed into travel literature recently, from naturalists, climbers, all sorts of different areas have come in, studying music, architecture, particularly a lot of interesting studies of architecture in specific cities. I think they've enriched it hugely. The likes of William Dalrymple have brought in a great deal of history and biography into it. I think there was an idea about 10 years ago where we had too many books with spurious reasons for the journey. Travels with my Donkey, Travels in My Baguette, Footsteps books are huge.
And Endless Provence books, isn't it?
Endless
as well,
Provence books. But I think those have largely disappeared, and I think what's been left behind is genuinely rich, as evidenced by these prizes we're talking about today.
Another point that I and Brian Schofield makes, Ian, is that he said there are a lot of voices coming from overseas, and maybe that's where the energy in writing is. And where are the funds to spend 2 years in the Kashmir? A rarely mentioned truth about an awful lot of travel writers these days is that they're a bit posh. What do you say to that?
I think that's probably true, although I wouldn't hold it against any of them. There has been, as Brett said earlier, I think in the mid-80s in Britain, there were an awful lot of books with titles like Hang Gliding Over Borneo or Sideways to Mandalay on a Rhinoceros, where travel writers, in order to simulate the artificial difficulties of Victorian exploration, were creating artificial difficulties for themselves. And even today, there are people who insist on going around on a bicycle when you could, you know, walk or take a bus. And these, I suppose, were people with a certain amount of money behind them, I don't know, or privilege. I think that one of my favourite travel writers is Norman Lewis, and he doesn't fit this stocked stereotype as a sort of patrician pathfinder mooching about the tropics with a faithful bearer. I mean, he was born in Enfield, the London suburb, and was the son of spiritualist ministers and opened up a camera shop in Holborn.
I mentioned a couple of the respondents on Twitter at the beginning of the podcast. We also had honourable mentions for Gerald Durrell's My Family and Other Animals, yes, set on Corfu, and Bruce Chatwin's in Patagonia. And one respondent mentioned Paul Theroux's Patagonian adventure, but said it's showing its age now. I mean, do you think that that's... That was very much the 1970s, 80s model of travel journalism. Do you think that's very dated now?
I think it's a little dated. For me, there's an awful lot of Theroux in Theroux, and that I've always regarded as a barrier to truly great travel writing. I know Theroux has huge numbers of fans. In a way, I think it's true of Chatwin, seems now a little dated to me in the way that he was writing. But these things come and go in fashions. I mean, we're seeing a huge... interest now in a lot of the classic travel writers of the 30s, 40s, 50s, and you know, even if you look at big greats like Patrick Leigh-Fermor, many people like William Blacker, again on the shortlist, are very much carrying on that tradition, which we might have said the sort of lyric, romantic travel writing was of the past. But all these things can be updated and revisited.
So that's William Blacker's Along the Enchanted Way, which was on the shortlist, as you said. Well, let's see if I can squeeze a recommendation out of you. Let's both of you recommend. What should people be picking up and taking with them on holiday this summer?
If we're looking at modern travel writers, I think have done something different. Roger Deakins, but Waterlog.
Oh, I love that too.
Wonderful, wonderful book. Again, what is travel literature? But this is Britain through a very different medium. And Wildwood, his other book, is also a lovely book. And perhaps... Now, William Fiennes' book, The Snow Geese, again, this was another strand coming into travel writing of following the snow geese on their journey. And Horatio Clare this year on this shortlist has picked up that strand. So
doing this, following a swallow.
Yeah, I might pick those two, but I'd love to put Norman Lewis in there. You could pick any one. I would pick Voices of the Old Sea.
Well, I'm a fan of Ian Sinclair, and I love his book on London Lights Out for the Territory, and I think that this is a writer who's always on the move, his sort of pavement pounding, and I love that aspect of his writing. It's not travel writing as such, although it is about a place, so I suppose it could be construed as travel. Another slightly unconventional choice of mine would be The Truce by Primo Levi, which was published in Italy in 1963. There's no other book for me which gives a more magnificent portrait of Eastern Europe on the in the immediate aftermath of the liberation of Auschwitz, where Levi is an Italian chemist, was interned by the Germans. And this book has a wonderful sense of sort of railway vagabondage and exuberant sort of comic mock misadventure in it that makes it, for me, as well as a sort of chronicle of the times, a great travel book. It's all saturated with a nostalgia too for one's homeland. And I think that makes it a very, very magnificent work of travel writing as well as anything else. Mm-hmm. And Norman Lewis's Naples 44.
Mm-hmm. Well, some very good recommendations there. Ian Thompson and Brett Wollstonecroft, thank you very much for coming in. The Dead Yard is published by Faber.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Watts, the Beijing correspondent for The Guardian. I'm here in China to interview Barbara Demick, who has just been awarded the Samuel Johnson Prize for her book Nothing to Envy, a tale of six North Koreans and their lives covering more than two decades. Barbara, welcome and congratulations. Can you start us off today by reading an extract from the opening chapter, which describes a relationship between two young people in North Korea at a time of blackouts.
The darkness confers measures of privacy and freedom as hard to come by in North Korea as electricity. Wrapped in a magic cloak of invisibility, you can do what you like without worrying about the prying eyes of parents, neighbors, or secret police. I met many North Koreans who told me how much they learned to love the darkness, but it was the story of one teenage girl and her boyfriend that impressed me the most. She was 12 years old when she met a young man 3 years older from a neighboring town. Her family was low-ranking in the Byzantine system of social controls in place in North Korea. To be seen in public together would damage the boy's career prospects as well as her reputation as a virtuous young woman. So their dates consisted entirely of long walks in the dark. There was nothing else to do anyway. By the time they started dating in earnest in the early 1990s, none of the restaurants or cinemas were operating because of the lack of power. They would meet after dinner. The girl had instructed her boyfriend not to knock on the front door and risk questions from her older sisters, younger brother, or the nosy neighbors. They lived squeezed together in a long, narrow building behind which was a common outhouse shared by a dozen families. The houses were set off from the street by a white wall just above eye level in height. The boy found a spot behind the wall where nobody would notice him as the light seeped out of the day. The clatter of the neighbors washing the dishes or using the toilet masked the sound of their footsteps. He would wait for hours for her, maybe two or three. It didn't matter. The cadence of life is slower in North Korea. Nobody owned a watch. The girl would emerge just as soon as she could extricate herself from the family. Stepping outside, she would peer into the darkness, unable to see him at first, but sensing with certainty his presence. She wouldn't bother with makeup. No one needs it in the dark. Sometimes she just wore her school uniform, a royal blue skirt cut modestly below the knee, a white blouse and red bow tie, all of it made from a crinkly synthetic material. She was young enough not to fret about her appearance. At first, they would walk in silence. Then their voices would gradually rise to whispers and then to normal conversational levels as they left the village and relaxed into the night. They maintained an arm's length distance from each other until they were sure they wouldn't be spotted. The night sky in North Korea is a sight to behold. It might be the most brilliant in Northeast Asia, the only place spared the coal dust, Gobi Desert sand, and carbon monoxide choking the rest of the continent. In the old days, North Korean factories contributed their share to the cloud cover, but no longer. No artificial lightning competes with the intensity of the stars etched into the sky. The young couple would walk through the night, scattering ginkgo leaves in their wake. What did they talk about? Their families, their classmates, books they had read, whatever the topic, it was endlessly fascinating. Years later, when I asked the girl about the happiest memories of her life, she told me of those nights.
Thanks, Barbara. That's an extract from the opening chapter. It takes in this wonderful relationship between the star-crossed lovers, Miran and Junsang. And this idea of holding hands in the dark, it really sets the tone of the whole book. And it's what sets the book apart, this fact that there's romance and happiness. Mm-hmm. And these are words that we don't normally associate with North Korea. Other writers on the subject tend to focus on the misery of food shortages, anger at the totalitarian political system, or the dramas of escapes across the border. And you cover all of those areas, but you also run the full gamut of emotions by adding hope and love. Was that something you set out to do from the very beginning, or was it an approach that evolved during the course of your studies and your research and your interviews?
No, John, I wanted to do, you know, the whole life of North Koreans, and I wanted to do how they lived, not just death. And in order to, you know, present a complete portrait, you have to show both sides. I think it was Primo Levi who said there's no such thing as complete misery. In fact, I remember this quote very clearly from Survival in Auschwitz. You know, he said, just as the same way that you're never completely happy, you're never completely miserable either, even in a concentration camp. And you know, North Korea is beyond that. People do have happy memories. And I found when I interviewed them, what I have certain stock questions I ask. They're kind of trick questions, but one of the trick questions was, what is your happiest memory from your life in North Korea? But I would ask that question just to jar people into remembering their lives before. And in fact, it was that question that led me to the story of Mi-ran and Jun-sang, because I asked her the question and she told me about walking in the dark with her boyfriend.
Do you think it's necessary for authors to just counterbalance the tendency, particularly amongst journalists, and we are both journalists, that we do tend to emphasize the extremes when we cover countries, especially perhaps an isolated place like North Korea, in particular in a country like North Korea where the focus is so much on the leader, who's become a sort of either a figure of horror or a comic figure. And there's such a focus on him a lot of the time that we sometimes forget about the other 22 million people who live in the country.
That's right. People don't really bother talking to North Koreans at any great length because I think there's an assumption, maybe correct, that they don't matter much. They have no control over the future of their country. So you don't get the whole flavor of their life and you don't understand what has been lost in that country until you know what they had and how they lived.
You intertwine the lives of six people. There's the party loyalist, the doctor, the street kid, the teenage rebel. The dominant narrative really is this relationship between the lovers, Mi-ran and Jun-sang. And there's a kind of a purity in their affair. That's actually very North Korean, isn't it? That often doesn't come across, but that sort of strange purity.
That's right. And the North Koreans are very prudish about sex and dating. You know, this is another surprising thing. When I was in South Korea, I would always say to ask North Koreans, what's the thing that you're most surprised about life in South Korea? And I always thought it would be the food or the internet or something technology, but they'd always say the way couples make public displays of affection, that they would hold hands in public or, you know, oh my God, you know, kiss in public. So this is going back to a very innocent relationship. You know, this kind of love could not thrive in a culture where you're text messaging and IMing and, you know, Skyping and Facebooking. This is a couple who were sending letters to each other that took months to get from Pyongyang to Cheongjin, 275 miles away from one another. And, you know, this is, again, in the 1990s. This is not ancient history. This is a time when their neighbor, South Korea, was already the most wired country in the world.
And I mean, how long did it take even for their first kiss? It was years, wasn't it?
It was years. I'm trying to remember. I think it was about 6 years.
I'd like to talk briefly about the narrative style. Now, you really get into the heads of your characters. You feel what they're feeling. You think what they're thinking. What was the process in terms of the interviews you needed to do, the thought process, the writing process that enabled you to really enter into the characters in that way?
I spent a lot of time with these people. I've, by the way, interviewed more than 100 North Korean defectors, maybe several hundred. I interviewed many people from the same town, 30, 40. But these six were chosen in part because they were willing to give the time. They were interested, and some of them are quite busy, but they were interested enough in the project that they were willing to give me their time and their honesty, because I had to ask them very personal questions. And it takes a long time to interview somebody from another culture, not just a North Korean, but you know, any foreigner. I know there were times where I would say, you know, describe your house to me. And they would say, you know, yeah, it's a, you know, typical North Korean house. And I would say, yeah, just like mine. I grew up in a typical house in the suburbs of New York, very boring middle class house. Do you know what my house looked like? No. You know, so I would have them do, you know, little pictures of their houses, and we would go over what was on this wall, what was on that wall, what was in the kitchen. For their part, even though some of them were very busy, they wanted to tell because they felt in South Korea, I think that people didn't understand them.
And in the book, there are some really horrific but very powerful passages where you describe what happens as a person starves to death. And I wonder about the situation, how you see it now. I mean, for perhaps a lot of the 10 years, the general impression has been North Korea is still suffering, but perhaps getting better. Mm-hmm. But then in the past year, in fact, in the past week, there have been statements by South Korean NGOs that the situation is starting to deteriorate again.
That's right. That's right.
What's your understanding of how things are now?
Things are actually veering back to the worst days of the 90s, I believe. You're absolutely right. It had gotten a lot better the last 4 or 5 years. But the regime really has willfully push themselves back into the dark ages. I'm not even talking about the nuclear program. I'm talking about this absolutely absurd currency revaluation they did late last year as a way of stripping the nascent middle class of whatever savings they had. They closed all the markets, and they basically caused their own economy to collapse. People had been pulling themselves out of a bare subsistence existence, you know, where they were still malnourished, but they were living, and they just, you know, plunged right back down.
Well, to end on a slightly different note, do you still keep in touch with the six people who are covered in this book, and how do they feel about it, and the award if they know about it?
What's funny, I had dinner with Jun Song last week, right before the award was announced, and he was really happy. He's the boyfriend in the book and the most literate of the six. In fact, he's the one. There's a picture of him at the end of the book with carrying a copy of George Orwell's 1984 in Korean. And yeah, they're thrilled. And you know, honestly, they wanted people to understand them.
Jonathan Watts talking to Barbara Demick. Nothing to Envy is published by Granta. And that's it from us today on the Books Podcast. We'll be back next week with Jonathan Raban and the Literature of Landscape. Meanwhile, in the Guardian Saturday Review, poet laureate Carol Ann Duffy has a treat for you. She's persuaded some of the country's most illustrious poets to pen some lines about sport. In the Observer's new review on Sunday, Robert McCrum meets Carl Melantes, who has spent the last 35 years working on a novel about his experience of the Vietnam War. And the book's website will be running a special 50th anniversary bag of tributes to Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird. Until next week, thanks for listening. I'm Claire Armistead, and the programme was produced by Scott Corley.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.